My name is Michael McCusker. If you have been paying any attention to the news, which is probably impossible in these days not to, it saturates every pore. We know that people are fighting for their independence, their political civil rights in places in Africa. And we seem to be doing the opposite here. Even though there are mass demonstrations against a particular political party, it wants to destroy the rights of the common folk through the unions. And that's what I'd like to read this morning. I'll start off with a couple of articles in the so-called, well, one is the mainstream press, the other is The Nation, and then I'll read something of my own. The first is by Ezra Klein, who writes for the Washington Post, and this article of his appeared in the Sunday Oregonian February 20th. Wisconsin's fiscal woes. Unions aren't to blame for deficits, by Ezra Klein. Let's be clear. Whatever fiscal problems Wisconsin is or is not facing at the moment, they are not caused by labor unions. That's also true for New Jersey, for Ohio, and for the other states. There was no sharp rise in collective bargaining in 2006 and 2007, no major reforms of the country's labor laws, no dramatic change in how unions organize. And yet state budgets collapsed, revenues plummeted, taxes had to go up, and spending had to go down all across the country. Blame the banks. Blame global capital flows. Blame lax regulation of Wall Street. Blame home buyers or home sellers. But don't blame the unions, not for this recession. Of course, the fact that public employee pensions didn't cause a meltdown at Lehman Brothers doesn't mean they are not stressing state budgets, and that the pensions they've been promised don't exceed what state budgets seem able to bear. But the buildup of global capital that overheated the housing sector and got packaged into seemingly riskless financial products that then brought down Wall Street, paralyzing the economy, throwing millions out of work, and destroying the revenues from state income and sales taxes even as state residents needed more social services? The answer to that is not to end collective bargaining for public employees, which is what Governor Scott Walker is attempting in Wisconsin. In fact, it particularly doesn't work for what Walker is attempting in Wisconsin. The Badger State was actually in pretty good shape. It was supposed to end this budget cycle with about $120 million in the bank. Instead, it's facing a deficit. Why? I'll let the state's official fiscal scorekeeper explain. More than half of the lower estimate, $117.2 million, is due to the impact of Special Session Senate Bill 2, Health Savings Accounts, Assembly Bill 3, Tax Deductions and Credits for Relocated Businesses, and Assembly Bill 7, Tax Exclusion for New Employees. In English, the governor signed two business tax breaks and a conservative health care policy experiment that lowers overall tax revenues. The new legislation was not offset, and it turned a surplus into a deficit. As Brian Butler writes, public workers are being asked to pick up the tab for this agenda. But even that's not the full story here. Public employees are not being asked to make a one-time payment into the state's coffers. Rather, Walker is proposing to sharply curtail their right to bargain collectively. A cyclical downturn that isn't their fault, plus an unexpected reversal in Wisconsin's budget picture that wasn't their doing, is being used to permanently end their ability to negotiate what their health insurance should look like. That's how you keep a crisis from going to waste. You take a complicated problem that requires the apparent need for bold action and use it to achieve a long-time ideological objective. In this case, permanently weakening public employee unions, a group much loathed by Republicans in general and by the Republican legislators who have to battle them in elections in particular. If you read Walker's State of the State address, you can watch him hide the ball on what he's doing. Our upcoming budget is built on the premise that we must right-size our government, he said. That means reforming public employee benefits, as well as reforming entitlement programs and reforming the state's relationship with local governments. Not a word on his actual proposal, which is to end collective bargaining for benefits. If all Walker was doing was reforming public employee benefits, I'd have little problem with it. There's too much deferred compensation in public employee packages, and though the blame for that structure lies partially with the government officials and state residents who wanted to pay later for services now, it is true that situations change and unsustainable commitments require reforms. But that's not what Walker is doing. He is attacking the right to bargain collectively, which is to say, he is attacking the very foundation of labor unions and of worker power, and using an economic crisis unions didn't cause and a budget reversal that Walker himself helped create to justify it. And it's not as if public employees aren't hurting. In the Wisconsin budget report I quoted earlier, the state's fiscal bureau goes on to survey the state of the economy. Quote, going forward, Global Insight expects private sector payrolls to grow by 2.1 million in 2011, 2.6 million in 2012, and 2.5 million in 2013. Projected cutbacks in the number of public sector employees, however, are expected to partially offset those private sector gains. In 2010, the number of state and local government employees fell by an estimated 208,000 positions. In 2011, those cutbacks are expected to total an additional 150,000 positions, unquote. In other words, private jobs are coming back, but state and local jobs are still being lost. Public employee unions are on the mat. Walker is trying to make sure they don't get back up. And that was Unions Aren't to Blame for Deficits by Ezra Klein, who is a writer for the Washington Post and appeared in the Sunday Oregonian February 20th. Now I'd like to pick up The Nation for February 21st, 2011, I guess a day later. And the conservative class war continued. This is by Eric Alterman. It was a terrible tabloid tale. While New York City was buried under a blizzard, widows and orphans freezing and starving in their apartments, union fat cats swigged brewskis and chuckled to themselves as sanitation workers conspired to stage a slowdown to gain leverage in their contract negotiations. The selfish sanitation bosses who sabotaged the blizzard cleanup to fire a salvo at City Hall targeted politically connected and well-heeled neighborhoods in Queens and Brooklyn to get their twisted message across loud and clear, screamed Rupert Murdoch's New York Post. From there, the story ricocheted across the media to Investor's Business Daily, to Fox News, naturally, and even to Saturday Night Live. The Washington Times ran an op-ed that began, "Cross us and people will die." Alas, it never happened. The source of all this hysteria was a sketchy story told by Daniel Halloran, a rookie councilman and Tea Party Republican, who is also an adherent of the neo-pagan religion Theodicism, if that's being pronounced correctly, I don't know. A New York Times investigation weeks later found no evidence to support the allegation, and it turns out that Halloran isn't so sure about what he thought he heard after all. But the damage is done. Murdoch properties are not exactly famous for correcting their errors, though, to be fair, if they did, there would hardly be time or space for anything else. Can it be mere coincidence that the right-wing media promoted this phony baloney story at a moment when, as Charles Loveless, legislative director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, ACSME, points out, conservatives are, quote, readying a massive assault, unquote, on the pensions and benefits of these same employees? Led by Newt Gingrich, who seems to be taking his first steps for the presidency, Conservatives are floating the notion that states should be allowed to declare bankruptcy to escape their pension obligations to firefighters, cops, teachers, and yes, sanitation workers. Gingrich called on House Republicans, quote, to move a bill in the first month or so of their tenure to create a venue for state bankruptcy, unquote. This was followed by a plea in the Weekly Standard by University of Pennsylvania law professor David Skeel titled, Give States a Way to Go Bankrupt. Skeel later told a reporter that he had never had anything I've written get as much attention as that piece. He said he had been contacted by lawmakers from all over. Depending on the audience, this discussion serves multiple purposes. Most obviously, it is intended to blame the unions for local fiscal woes and garner support from the public for the coming assault on their pensions. Second, it serves to intimidate the unions and encourage givebacks, lest these same officials be forced to go before taxpayers with a plan to cut services, raise taxes, or both, making public unions the culprit in any of those options. Third, it weakens the union's appeal to new workers, for if they can't protect the pension of their workers, what's the point of joining in the first place? Given that public unions provide the lion's share of poll workers, envelope stuffers, and other volunteers for Democratic campaigns, this is hardly an ancillary benefit from the rights perspective. With private union membership now in single digits, I think it's 31% actually, public unions remain just about the only institutions with sufficient financial and organizational muscle to make a difference in close elections at the state and local levels or to organize progressive pushback against corporate malfeasance. The assault on public employee unions is the next phase of a 40-year class war in America by the rich against the rest of us. It is of a piece with the steady dismantling of our progressive taxation system and the explosion of economic inequality. Total income going to the wealthiest 1% of Americans has risen from about 8% in the 1960s to more than 20% today. As Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson demonstrate in their recent book, Winner Take All Politics, this is the result of deliberate policy choices made by politicians in the service of those who fund their campaigns. Congress has repeatedly cut tax rates on top earners, along with capital gains and estate taxes. And as Robert Lieberman, writing in Foreign Affairs, recalls, during the 1990s, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, which regulates accounting practices, attempted to put a stop to the practice of allowing corporate CEOs to compensate themselves with massive stock option packages, correctly predicting that it would lead to an epidemic of deceptive accounting practices. But Congress, spurred on by the lobbying efforts of major corporations, stopped the FASB in its tracks, and that's Lieberman. The result? For the past 20 years, we've allowed CEOs to enrich themselves at the expense of employees and stockholders through the mutual back-scratching habits of corporate boards. In the meantime, statistics demonstrate the speciousness of the conservative case for states facing budget crises to default on their public pension obligations. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities released a report recently demonstrating that, in fact, they have adequate tools and means to meet their obligations, quote unquote. To the degree that some states appear to be in real trouble, explains a June report last year, by two Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco analysts, this is the result of a profound macroeconomic shock rather than pension obligations. Yet another recent study, this one from Boston College's Center for Retirement Research, found that while many state pension funds may be substantially underfunded, they account for just 3.8% of state and local spending and could be covered with an increase to just 5%. Yet snow jobs, like those promoted by Murdoch, Gingrich, and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and you can add Wisconsin's Walker, are painting a bullseye on the back of public unions. People I don't even know are calling me horrible names. Marie Corfield, a New Jersey art teacher who found herself on the other end of New Jersey's Christie's anti-union rant, told the New York Times. The mantra, she said, is that the problem is the unions, the unions, the unions. And that was Eric Alterman. The conservative class war continued, and it appeared in The Nation magazine, February 21st. And now I'd like to read something I've written and rewritten and rewritten. And you might have heard some or parts of it one time or another in its different evolutions or disguises, whichever you might think it to be. I call it Union Dues. And with a couple of quotes, Abraham Lincoln: labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. And Franklin D. Roosevelt: if I went to work in a factory, the first thing I would do would be to join a union. And I must give a disclaimer, I guess, that this might just be my opinion and my opinion only in the entire cosmos. But I hope not, and I don't think so. Union Dues, by yours truly. I was president for 3 years of a small company union affiliated with a much larger parent union. I was not so much an activist president as I was a caretaker attempting to hold together an unpopular union that seldom had the support or participation of its rank and file. I represented a membership that was generally inactive and unhappy they must pay union dues on salaries barely above minimum wage, which the union was not very successful raising. I was president during two contract negotiations, and we did not score well with wage raises or benefits. Management stonewalled us with shrinking state social services budgets. We were a member of a public union. 1 year, the rank and file rejected a contract in which they lost benefits and received no wage raises in exchange, nor cost of living. They accepted a second offering that did not raise wages, but at least retained the earlier lost benefits. Of course, management awarded itself rather generous raises and benefits. I wrote a letter to the wage slaves I represented, admitting the union side of the table had poorly negotiated the most recent contract and urged they vote it down. Quote, some of you believe the union is just another bureaucracy that takes money out of your paychecks. Most of you rarely attend union meetings or participate in decisions that affect you, yet the union is your opportunity to have a voice and a measure of power over your working lives, the more so the more you participate. You can choose to vote down this contract and demand we get you a better deal than we have, which we cannot guarantee, unless you show management that you are actively involved to increase the union's strength and potency. Of greater importance is that you take the power the union offers you to determine your working future. Unquote. My small company union signified much that beleaguers unions these days. After nearly a generation of savage union busting and massive layoffs begun during the Reagan years, they are at their weakest since the 1950s when they were bloated and corrupt and notoriously indifferent to their rank and file. Although grievously weakened and suffering a tremendous loss of political power, it is possible that claims the labor movement is in its death throes are exaggerated despite current assaults on public unions. As the man or woman says, unions are bad, but without them it's worse. That perception is all too apparent when tens of thousands of workers lose their jobs while, despite the recession depression, corporate profits are up. The discrepancy in wages and benefits between management and labor is obscene, and the people who have jobs are required to produce more for less pay with little or no job security. The power of American labor unions as a force to represent the rights of workers in American industry has faded over the past decades. This erosion of social and political equity of people who produce the gross national product of the American market is due in part to an increasing global economy and to international competition and ease of capital flight. Union strike power is vulnerable to diversified multinational megacorporations, especially in highly automated industries, and is virtually powerless to halt overseas relocations. Union busting has decimated some of the country's largest and formerly strongest unions. Labor law has failed to protect workers, and government acts as a tool for the company. Corporations breach labor laws and are not held accountable. Union strikers are arrested and heavily fined. The bitter assault by government and industry has crippled union power to such an extent that unions are unable to gain significant wage raises or protect the jobs of hundreds of thousands who are sacrifices to company mismanagement and corruption, downsizing, especially during this recession, depression, or divestiture as a result of incessant corporate takeovers and mergers. The American labor movement succumbed to its own success and the long-savored vengeance of the bosses it temporarily trumped. The power labor gained, which for decades was immense, was bitterly won and carelessly lost. When the Reagan administration chose to attack in the early 1980s by breaking a strike by aircraft controllers and forever banned the strikers from government work, it was aware the labor movement was weak and unable to resist a savage campaign of union busting. Unions were by then little more than huge bureaucracies that had lost contact with their rank and file. Their leaders were raised to social levels, with salaries and perks, equal to executives of similar ranks. Dissent was usually squelched within the locals, while union and corporate officials colluded on the same class level. For members of most unions, mandatory dues were, and remain, a tax on their wages at the same time they were denied meaningful or coherent representation. The corporate class bitterly resented the labor movement's power and exacted cruel revenge throughout the Reagan, Bush senior years, attacking the unions in their shops like wolves circling downed beasts. The older industrial unions were ripped apart. Thousands of workers were forced to take huge pay cuts and the loss of medical and insurance benefits to keep their jobs in industries that were crippled, dismantled, or sold off. Many thousands more were laid off when plants closed or relocated offshore. Communities that depended on smokestack or sold-off industries paid huge ransoms to keep them operating or to attract newer ones. Top echelons of corporations dismantled their subsidiaries to protect their headquarters bastions from corporate raiders, in the meantime feeding on each other in a frenzy of takeovers. Their unions gutted and powerless to protect them, American workers were pawns and generally losers in the bloody corporate wars, disinherited at the same time American corporations employed foreign labor to make their products at cheaper cost. The new realities of world commerce aggravates the problem affecting American labor. American corporations subsidize cheaper labor and manufacturing costs in third world nations by ordering finished products from them instead of producing domestically, which adds not only to imbalance of trade but shrinks the numbers of jobs for American workers. Real work shifts overseas where the only competition is in degrading wages and increasing production, especially among young women reminiscent of U.S. sweatshops in the early 20th century and more recently in the Pacific Southwest. As the American working force shrinks, the power of the already weakened unions is further eroded. Workers in need of work accept low-paying and non-union jobs and lose their rights and protection, or they don't work at all. Trotsky was right when he said that labor must be universal instead of national because corporate industry is global. Jobs are cut in the U.S. and exported to third world countries with non-existent or harassed labor movements. Violations of international workers' rights are used for competitive advantage by U.S. corporations that are searching the world for impoverished countries with low-wage workers, even employing slave and prison labor while engaging in destroying labor movements and imprisoning or murdering labor leaders. Unions once were, in the words of Kurt Vonnegut, admirable instruments for extorting something like economic justice from employers. But labor is badly wounded and its history is treated like pornography. Strikes are crippled with injunctions and workers are denied government aid while on strike. Union busting has frightened union leaders into painful compromises and binding agreements are torn up by management. The legal framework of the labor movement needs radical change. Political solutions in which workers' rights and union democracy in its broadest sense are guaranteed are necessary. A generous concept of labor democracy would give workers more rights, both in collective bargaining and law, and would allow them a voice in investment policy and in such matters as layoffs, plant shutdowns, takeovers, and selection of top management. The tax code should be revised to credit companies that avoid layoffs in profitable times and give employees a stake in company policy as well as good medical coverage and broad retraining opportunities. Workers' rights should be manifested in various ways that would prohibit employer interference in their decisions about organizational representation, which should include unions with only a minority of workers, and mandate collective bargaining that leads to solid contracts. Radical changes in labor law must obviously be accompanied with wide involvement of women, blacks, Asian, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans, plus physically handicapped and mentally retarded workers, and should focus on a social crusade framed as an extension of American democracy instead of pressure group whining. A special effort should be made to recreate a social justice movement like civil rights in the 1960s. Such a sharply defined crusade would be an initial stage in educating and mobilizing union members. The next objective would be for these members to spread labor's gospel as far as possible in schools, churches, civic meetings, political caucuses. To bring strong political support into the labor movement, more workers need to be organized and be willing to risk and endure long-standing picket lines, like automobile mechanics who both lost their strike and their jobs several years ago in Astoria, Oregon. They were on the line for years. Rebirth of a robust labor movement requires enfranchising women and minorities, the rise of vigorous new leaders untainted by corruption, reversing the decline and increased costs of education, and most importantly, collective action and collective bargaining to halt labor's collapse in post-industrial America. Re-establishment of a union culture in the United States and radical reforms of union laws must be a primary goal for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political health and survival. The bottom line is representing the rank and file. There is a tendency in unions, as in management and any other group, for power to flow to the top, and for elected union officials to form a clique of sorts that distances itself from the rank and file, exacerbated by contact with paid union officials whose business is generally with local union leaders rather than the membership. It does not matter whether a union officer likes or despises the rank and file. They vote and pay dues to be adequately and fairly represented, whether they are active or a bunch of deadheads grousing about union dues extracted from their paychecks. And if only 3 or 4 union members participate in elections, attend meetings, and are active, a union's job is still to represent the entire membership. The first permanent national labor organization in the United States, the International Typographical Union, acknowledged at its first convention in 1850, quote, "It is useless for us to disguise from ourselves the fact that, under the present arrangement of things, there exists a perpetual antagonism between labor and capital, one side striving to sell their labor for as much, and the other striving to buy it for as little as they can." That seemingly perpetual polarity has not changed. Perhaps most of you are vague or do not particularly respond to what our ancestors considered necessary fundamentals for maintaining personal and political liberty, but erosions of them will eventually ruin your lives, I wrote in my letter to my union rank and file when I was their president. Democracy is always in flux between those who wish to protect and enlarge it and those who reduce and confine it. We are in a period of severe decline of the personal and political rights of people who work for a living, which makes it imperative we understand what is at stake on the job and in the democracy at large. And that was something I wrote, union dues. And again, the disclaimer that it just might represent my opinion only in the entire cosmos, but I rather doubt it. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.